Okay, so let's get started. Welcome everybody to the sixth and final workshop of the Early Buddhism course. Congratulations on sticking with us through to the end, and special congratulations on braving the weather. So only those really committed ones have showed up for today. Everybody else is still snuggling under the doona. Okay, and I did hear on the grapevine that a few people missed out last workshop because it was on a different weekend, or there was a confusion about the date. So apologies for that, and we'll remember that if we do it again next time to make that more clear about when the date of the workshop is. So for this month, we're looking at the early Buddhism here and now, and we want to try to ask questions about how what we've learnt can be applied . Perth in 2013 is not the same as India in 500 BC. You may have noticed there's a few things that are different, and so how do we adapt to that? How does the Dhamma apply in those very different circumstances? Obviously, this is not something for which there's a simple answer. But anyway, we hope to maybe raise a few questions and even make a few practical suggestions and examples. Before we go on to that, though, we'd like to take the chance to recap the major themes of the past workshops. So this is what we'll start out with. And one of the most striking features of the Buddha's teachings in the suttas is his use of the ABA format. You start out with making a statement, it's A, and then you either elaborate the statement or give examples or a simile or something, and that's your B, and then you repeat the same statement again, and that's your A. And this is a very common format in music and other forms of arts. And, of course, is exactly the same format that's used every evening in the 6:30 news, right? You begin by giving the headlines, then you give the details, and then you give the headlines again, right? And there's a reason for doing that, because it helps you to remember stuff. So the Buddha invented the format for the evening news, among other things. Quite remarkable, isn't it? So when we're considering the things that we've gone over, hopefully most of you have been to the earlier workshops, and so we will just try to do it quite briefly, but we want to give a bit of a survey about where we've come from and then begin to have a look at what lies ahead. Okay, so we began the course, and for this course we're going to do it a little bit differently, the format to how we've done it previously. And so Ajahn Brahmali and I are going to more or less tag team our way through each slide. Okay, so we're going to pick slides at random as they come up, and each one of us is going to do that one. So hopefully that will be entertaining for us anyway, even if not for you. So I get the first one. So Buddhism in history. First thing we looked at was Buddhism in history, and Buddhism as a product of history. Buddhism as something which is and always has been very deeply embedded in history. And I think this is something which we often forget, and it's a tendency we find in all religions to depict themselves as being somehow an eternal teaching. And we find basically every religion does this. They want somehow that it's eternal. And of course, the thing is that there is something about that which is quite true. I mean, there are some aspects of the Dhamma which are timeless, right? I mean, the fact that craving gives rise to suffering, I mean, this is timeless, yeah? And these core teachings of the Buddha actually are just as true today as they were in India in 500 BC. But of course, the many other aspects of it, the way that it's expressed, the specific issues that are discussed, the language, the ideas, and all of these kinds of things are quite different, and these things have all evolved throughout time. So it's almost an axiom or a truism to say that every form of Buddhism as practiced in Buddhist cultures sees itself as being a practice of early Buddhism in some way, that they all see themselves as practicing authentically what the Buddha taught. So what we're trying to do in this course is to question those assumptions, to critique the assumptions, and try to ask from a historical point of view what kind of basis there is to various claims about what the Buddha taught, what he didn't teach, and so on. Now, in terms of what we're actually doing here, the idea of what we call Buddhism in the modern times essentially stems from the work of the European Indologists of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It's difficult to overstate the importance of the work that was done, especially by Europeans in that time. Before that time, there was essentially no global conception of Buddhism as such. Okay, there were different, of course, Buddhist communities in different places, and some of those countries would recognize an affinity between themselves. So, for example, say Burma and Sri Lanka and Thailand, there were historical connections and so on, and there was a recognition that they were practicing the same religion, but there wasn't that same feeling about, say, Tibet or Japan or Mongolia and these other places. And so there wasn't really an idea of Buddhism as a religion, which was variants of which were practiced in these different countries. And that idea essentially came from the work of the European Indologists, who put that conception on a solid foundation by tracing all of those traditions back in a genuine historical sense to one teacher in India around 500 BC, who we call the Buddha. So the picture of the history which evolved in the late 19th, early 20th century still provides the model for how we think of early Buddhism today. It's not equivalent in every respect. You can think of it as something a little bit analogous to, say, Darwinism, where Darwin comes along and lays down the essential framework for understanding. There's many changes and modifications and adaptions of his ideas since then, but the basic framework is still there. And so we still think of Buddhism in roughly the same way. We still think of the Buddha as being a teacher who attained enlightenment in India in 500 BC, living around the Ganges Plain area. We think of him as establishing a community, that community gradually spreading out with the great popularization of Buddhism under King Ashoka, and so on and so forth. And that framework was all established in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. So as well as the contributions by the European scholars, like T.W. Rhys-Davids and others, we also noted that these reforms and ideas which were developed by European scholars didn't happen in a vacuum. Modernity is not something which happened only in Europe. Modernity is something that happened the world over. And so the similar ideas played out in very different ways in the different traditional Buddhist cultures. Whereas in Europe, of course, most of these ideas remained more or less confined to an academic sphere. They became subjects of scholarly study and research and so on. Whereas in the traditional Buddhist cultures, many of the same ideas were applied in very practical ways. And here there are just a few examples of this that we've mentioned here. Ledi Sayadaw from Burma, who made any number of contributions and reforms in terms of understanding practice of Dhamma in Burma, ultimately leading to the new meditation movement that today we call Vipassana. Anagarika Dhammapala applying his... And so Ledi Sayadaw was essentially pivotal in the idea of Buddhism as scientific and irrational. So the idea of Buddhism as a rational psychology we can trace directly back to Ledi Sayadaw and his generation. And Anagarika Dhammapala, on the other hand, used the Dhamma and his idea of early Buddhism as a means for social reform, for creating an idea of a living Buddhist culture, which would provide the basis for a modern community and a modern nation state in the post-colonial era. Ajahn Mun in Thailand applied the Dhamma again in different ways, but he was very much a kind of back to the roots tradition, very emphasis on simplicity and, of course, on meditation. And it's from Ajahn Mun that we find very strong emphasis on the core meditation teachings which are taught constantly throughout the early Buddhist texts. the contemplation of the body, contemplation of impermanence, and breath meditation in particular. Whereas former meditations often practiced in places like Thailand and so on would be more along the lines of tantric and magical invocations rather than being anything that we would recognize as meditation today. So that was just a few examples through history of how these were developing in the same period and developing in connection and relation with each other, all of them taking ideas from what we call early Buddhism. So what you know, Venerable Brahmali and myself see ourselves in doing in this course is very much continuing in this tradition, that the early Buddhism is not a single or a static thing, but it's more like an inspiration or an idea which we can derive ideas and challenges and approaches that can help us in our spiritual practice. Okay, over to you.
Okay. So, is this working?
Yeah. It was working earlier.
Okay.
Is it on? Try hitting the button again.
This one here?
I don't know. It was working. I tested it earlier.
Okay. Oh, there we are.
No, that's not working, is it?
That's working, isn't it? Yeah, okay, good. Okay, so this is just a very brief timeline of some of the most important dates in early Buddhism, just to give some kind of background, some kind of grounding in what actually happens. These are basically historical facts, more or less, and that's why it's quite good to have that as a background when we talk about these issues. So the first thing here, which is quite interesting, is actually the dates of the Buddha himself, because until quite recently, until about 25 or 30 years ago, the dates of the Buddha were very highly uncertain, and nobody knew exactly when the Buddha actually lived. It was then agreed that Buddha was certainly a historical personality, but actually the precise time when he was around was actually very, very much debated in academia, etc. So this is quite a recent idea that the Buddha passed away. His parinibbana was about 400 BCE. And that is quite important, because prior to that, the idea was that the Buddha's parinibbana was about 480 BC, and that was kind of a modern idea already. And the traditional Theravadan idea was that the parinibbana was something like 520 BC, something like that? Is that the traditional one?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So by bringing the dates of the Buddha forward in this way, closer to our modern era, so to speak, you're actually bringing the Buddha more into history. And the reason for that is because the second factor you see here, the second part of this timeline, this is Chandragupta. Chandragupta was one of the very early monarchs of the Mauryan dynasty. He actually was the first monarch of the Mauryan dynasty. And he is actually more like a historical personage. He is known not only from the ancient Buddhist texts, he's also known through some of the other Indian texts. And also he's known through Greek history books also, Chandragupta actually occurs. So he is a historical personality in a very real sense. So by bringing the Buddha forward, you're actually bringing the Buddha more into history, closer to dates that we actually have some real information about. And that is very important, because it means that the comparison that you do, for example, with the facts that you find in the suttas, the narrative, the things you find about the society at the time of the Buddha, you can actually link it fairly well to a period which comes fairly close afterwards, which then is Chandragupta in particular. So Chandragupta was then perhaps the first kind of truly historical personage, although I think it's fair to say the Buddha also obviously is a historical person, but not quite as clearly defined as Chandragupta is. Then we have here the Second Council. The Second Council is very important, because the Second Council is like the beginning of when the Sangha and Buddhism is starting to split apart, essentially. This is where you have a big division in the Sangha, where they argue about the Vinaya points in particular. And this shows a trend after the Buddha. First, there's a time of consolidation of the suttas, a consolidation of the Dhamma, and then you start to get the arguments about what the Buddha actually taught. And this begins around this time. So this is what Bhantisiddhātu has aptly called, I think, emergent sectarianism, is that right? Begins about this time, when sectarianism in Buddhism starts to emerge from about this period. Then we have the important personality of Ashoka, of course, probably the greatest monarch in Indian history. And he is particularly important because of his link to Buddhism. And that link that Ashoka had to Buddhism has left large amounts of remnants in India. You find archaeological remains from his period. You find, of course, the famous Ashokan pillars, which were inscribed with all kinds of things, including, in some places, excerpts from Buddhist texts, and certainly references to Buddhist texts as well. So this is, in a sense, the first time in history that you find very clear and very unambiguous archaeological evidence for Buddhism. And that's I think, one of the most important facts about the Ashokan period. And it is only about, as you can see here, only about 150 years after the Buddha himself. So it's quite close. And you can, again, see the importance of bringing the Buddha forward in history. It brings it closer to such historical realities as the Ashokan period. And then the last point here is the Mahasanghika schism. This is the first real schism in Buddhist history. And this was a schism between the Mahasanghikas on the one hand and the Staviras on the other hand. Sometimes it is said that the Staviras are equivalent to the modern-day Theravadas. That, of course, is not the case at all. The Staviras were a very large group of the Sangha, which then, in their own right, then became the source of many new schools later on. But this is the first true schism in the Buddhist Sangha. And you will see here, that if you know a little bit about Buddhist history, you will notice that the date that we place here, or more like Ajahn Suddhato actually gives here, 150 BC, is much, much later than the normal understanding for when the first schism happened. Usually, in history books, you will find that the first schism is actually placed before the time of Ashoka. But in one of his interesting books on history, Ajahn Suddhato argues that actually it should be after the time of Ashoka. That is quite an interesting, and I think it is a very valid point that he makes. And I think it is it sort of changes the dynamic of Buddhist history quite a bit when you're aware of that. So that is the Mahasanghika schism. The word circa there is very important because it's highly unknown exactly when it happened. But to say somewhere between 200 and maybe 100 BC, something like that.
Something like that. Basically, the dates we have really is from the Shariputra Paripritcha in Chinese, which essentially, I think, puts the Mahasanghika schism around the time of the grandson of Ashoka, something like that. So we're thinking two or three generations after King Ashoka, really, is what that means. Yeah. Okay. So just again, look at a bit at the early schools. So we mentioned that the first schism was to the Mahasanghika and what's known as the Stavira. Those schools then split up into what's nominally called 18 early schools, although in fact there's both more and less than 18. There's more in the sense that if we counted up all the variants, we'd probably end up with about 30 or so, but there's much less in the sense that most of those variants were just kind of local establishments, which were not really different from the parent schools. So the main schools which are really relevant and important for us, and they emerged in the post-Ashokan period, obviously the Theravada school, historically, who called themselves the Mahaviharavasins, the dwellers in the great monastery at Anuradhapura. Sarvastivada is very important. They were dominant in much of northern India, up as far as Kashmir. And also, they were the Sarvastivada and Mula Sarvastivada. It's hard to distinguish between them sometimes. But they were also the dominant schools in the early period in Eastern Asia, throughout Burma, Thailand, Indonesia, and so on. As far as Vietnam, we find mostly the Sarvastivada or Mula Sarvastivada mentioned in the early period. By early period now, I'm talking 7, 8, 900, the early period in that region, I mean. So Theravada, Sarvastivada, and their importance for us is because many, many, many of their texts have been preserved. And we have most of the suttas from the Sarvastivadins. We have the Vinaya in Chinese. We have substantial amounts of their Abhidhamma, both in Chinese and in Sanskrit. Mula Sarvastivada, we have the Vinaya in Chinese, Tibetan, and Sanskrit. And there's also probably some suttas of the Mula Sarvastivada. It's often not easy to tell which one of those schools, whether it's Sarvastivada or Mula Sarvastivada. There's really not much difference between the two schools. Probably the difference is that Mula Sarasvati was based in Mathura, the Sarasvati in Kashmir. Dharmaguptaka is another very important school, almost identical in every respect to the Sri Lankan Theravada school. In fact, the only doctrinal difference which is recorded, there are ancient texts which discuss literally hundreds of points of disagreement in doctrines between the different schools. And the only difference in agreement between the Dharmaguptaka and Theravada is that the Dharmaguptaka say that offerings to a... let me get this straight now. Offerings to a Buddha is worth more than offerings to... You get more merit from offering to a Buddha than you do from offering to a Sangha, whereas the Theravada says you get more from offering to a Sangha than you do from offering to a Buddha. Okay? That's the only difference. I think we can learn to live with that. Okay? So Dharmaguptaka were based up in Gandhara, probably founded by a Greek monk, Yonika Dhammarakita, and they were certainly the group, one of the groups which spread earliest to China. And so we have their Vinaya in Chinese, we have the Dirghagama in Chinese, and an Abhidhamma text of theirs, as well as various other texts in Gandhari and other languages, and very important for modern times because their Vinaya is the Vinaya which is practiced by all of the East Asian Sangha. Okay, so Sangha from China, Vietnam, Korea, Taiwan, Japan, in as far as they have ordained Sangha, and where else? That's the main ones, is all Dharmaguptaka Vinaya. And Mula Sarasvati Vinaya, I should have mentioned, is that followed by the Central Asian traditions, so Tibet, Bhutan, Mongolia, and so on. Mahasangika is also important. We have their copy of their Vinaya in Chinese translation, certain suttas as well. And Mahasangika is also always very interesting because they were the... All of these other groups belonged to the Stavira group of schools. So in the first schism, you had the Mahasangika and Staviras. All of these other groups are part of the Stavira group of schools. Mahasangika, we don't have all of that much literature from that group of schools. We have some. And so that's interesting as representing the other branch of that original schism. The Mahasangika Vinaya has been argued by some scholars to be early, and earlier even than the Pali Vinaya, but I disagree with those scholars, and I think it's actually somewhat later than the Pali Vinaya. Mahishasika, another early school, and Mahishasika Vinaya was brought from Sri Lanka to China by Fa Xian in about 430 and translated into Chinese. So this is the bulk of the texts that we have from early Buddhism. And as you can see, we have a reasonable range, but of course only a small proportion of what was originally there, which is, I mean, as a textual scholar, you have to be somewhat thankful. It'd be a complete nightmare if we had all the texts of all the schools. We'd never be finished. But anyway, we've got enough to have a reasonable idea and a spread of what was actually present among all the schools. Should I talk about the doctrinal differences between them? Briefly I'll talk about the doctrinal differences. Theravada, main emphasis in the Theravada was the idea of impermanence and not self. The main emphasis in Sarvasivada was the idea that all dhammas, past, present and future, exist. Okay? Very interesting idea, which has certain philosophical similarities with some interpretations of quantum mechanics, apart from other things. But anyway, Dharmaguptaka, as I mentioned, Sarvasivara and Mula Sarvasivara are basically identical doctrinally. Dharmaguptaka, as I mentioned, is pretty much identical with Theravada. Mahasangika, their main difference was on the status of the arahant. So the Mahasangika believed that the arahant, they were kind of moving towards saying that the arahants weren't quite so cool and the Buddhas were much cooler. Whereas the Theravada was saying, no, arahants are really cool as well. Okay? That was the main doctrinal difference between them. Okay? And Mahishasika, again, very similar to the Dharmaguptaka and Theravada. I'm not aware of any major doctrinal differences between them. Yeah. That's right, yeah. Well, the Sarvasivad, so the question is, what does it mean when we say all the Dhammas, past, present and future, exist? Well, the problem, the source of the problem really is karma, right? So the problem is that you have karma, which is from the past, but it influences the present. And then that raises the whole question of continuity and personality. Like, everything's impermanent, which is fine, but like, reality isn't just like a pile of sand, right? It's not like everything just exists in kind of discrete lumps which have no connection to other things. So then the question, how can events which have happened in the past actually influence what's going on in the future? Now, of course, according to the Theravadin school, they answered that question by developing a theory of causality. Okay, so it's a theory of conditions. The things that happen in the past cause things that happen in the future, but they don't actually exist. Whereas the Sarvasivadins developed an idea that the things in the past and the future somehow exist, but only the things in the present are active. Okay? So the past, present, and future is not distinguished by existence, but by activity, by causal efficacy. Only things in the present can actually make things happen. Yeah. So you think about it, a nice analogy for it is actually if you have a bunch of links on a web page, all those links exist on the web page, but only the link you're hovering above is active. So it can actually do anything. The rest of them just kind of sit there. So it's only when you actually hover above that link and then you can click on it. Not yet, no. Well, this is where you need to talk to the Sarvasivadins. I mean, of course, Sarvasivadins was an extremely sophisticated and verbose philosophical community. And they developed long, long, long elaborate treaties and explanations of all of these things. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're interesting discussions because the important thing to remember with these things is not so much what's the right answer, okay? But why is it a problem, right? Why is this actually something of concern? So, of course, what's at stake here is the understanding of impermanence. And so what's the correct way to understand impermanence? And so that's whether you agree or not, but it's a genuine issue from a Buddhist point of view. How do you reconcile impermanence with continuity? Yeah. Okay, so let's have a short meditation. Okay, so moving ahead.
Okay, so we have just been looking at just very briefly the different schools of Buddhism. And that is, of course, one way of dividing up the Buddhist, kind of the Buddhist families, to divide up into schools. And when you divide up into schools, basically you're focusing on different aspects of Buddhism. You're looking at differences in doctrine, differences in interpretation, etc. That's what division in school does. But another way of dividing up Buddhism is to divide up into different languages. What are the different languages of the Buddhist texts? And this does not really focus so much on differences in doctrine or difference in understanding. And because of that, this is actually very useful for things like comparative studies of suttas, because you can take the suttas in different languages and then compare them, and then get some idea what perhaps the original sutta may have been like. Yeah. So of all these different languages, I think it's fair to say that the most important of all languages is the Pali language itself. And there is a couple of reasons for that. The first reason is because in the Pali, we basically have a complete set of texts in one specific language, and all belonging to one particular school. And you don't find that anywhere else. Even in the Chinese, you don't have a full set of texts that belong to one particular school. So the Pali is quite unique in that sense. That means you have a very broad scope, and you have a very broad idea of the Buddhist teachings because of that. And the second reason why the Pali is so important is that Pali is very close to the way the Buddha himself spoke, right? It's an Indian language from about the same period. And the difference between how the Buddha would have phrased his teachings and the way it is now found in the Pali tradition is actually very tiny, very, very small. Whereas once you get into the Chinese, you get into the Tibetan, you get into these other languages, you're talking about translation exercise. And when you translate a text, then regardless of how good you are, there's always going to be problems with translation. It's not going to be clear exactly how you... Remember here that we're talking about Chinese. It's a very, very different language from the ancient Indian languages. And because of that, it's often difficult to get an exact parallel in translation. Often it's virtually impossible. So something is always lost in translation. So for these two reasons, the Pali texts are often the main source that we use as Buddhists, regardless of which tradition you're in. But that does not mean that we necessarily rely exclusively on the Pali text, because one of the things about these other languages is that even though the translations may not be as good as the original, often they can show you if there is a mistake, for example, in the Pali transmission, then a different language of the same text can actually show you that mistake quite clearly in certain cases. And because of that, these other languages actually are quite important after all. And they can help you get a more reliable understanding of the Pali text themselves. So for that reason, all of these are actually quite important. The Chinese text, the importance of these, aside apart from being a corrective to the Pali text, another important thing about these texts is that they are not of one particular school. They are of many schools. And because they are of many schools, and because they were collected kind of haphazardly across India from different schools, different places, etc., often you have many examples of the same text. And this is one of the things that we saw on the previous slide, the Vinaya, the monastic Vinaya, for example, exists in six different versions in the Chinese. And you often find also similar kind of things as regards to the suttas. You find that certain individual suttas may exist in three or four different versions within the Chinese translation. So for that reason, they're quite interesting. And they can give you different a view of the same text, essentially. From there, we move on to the more marginal languages. And one of those marginal languages is the Tibetan language. It's quite important to be aware, to recognize that in Tibetan, there's only a very small amount of early suttas that actually exist in Tibetan. And the reason for that is because historically, Buddhism only came to Tibet. Maybe it started at the very beginning, maybe in about the 8th and 9th centuries. But the main influx of Buddhists into Tibet was around the 11th century or thereabout. That is very late in Buddhist history. It came from India. And because it's very late in Buddhist history, the agenda, so to speak, had changed in India in the meantime. Now the agenda was Mahayana. The agenda was perhaps Abhidhamma. The agenda was all kinds of other things, whereas the early suttas had kind of receded into the background. They weren't so important anymore. And because of that, what we have of the Tibetan canon is mostly later Buddhism. And that is why I think very often we find that when you see Tibetan Buddhists, the way they practice, you often feel it's slightly alien to the way we do things in Theravada. That is precisely because of that historical distance between the Tibetan tradition and the earlier traditions. Sanskrit here is a very important language simply because it is an early Indian language. So for that reason, it's very interesting when you compare the Sanskrit to the Pali. If you know Pali, you can almost read Sanskrit straight off the page because it's so similar. So for that reason, it's important because it is, again, very close to how the Buddha himself taught, right? So that for that reason, it's important. The reason it's not so important is because there aren't that many texts that exist still in Sanskrit. When we use the word Sanskrit here, it's important to understand this does not mean a classical Sanskrit always. It can mean classical Sanskrit, but it actually refers to a very broad range of languages. Some of these are known as Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit because they are a kind of approximate Sanskrit, but not actually the real classical Sanskrit that was codified by Panini, the famous Indian grammarian. There's a whole range of languages, really, we're talking about here, but they're all very similar, very close together. And then you also have Buddhist texts in some other languages. These are mostly Central Asian languages, like Uyghur, for example. You may have heard about the Uyghurs of Western China. You have languages like Khotanese and Sogdian and all these other languages. These are kind of very marginal languages in Buddhism. But there are some Buddhist texts in these ones as well. And then you have the archaeological scene, which really begins with Ashoka. And the very earliest fragments of Buddhist texts are already found at that time, where Ashoka might refer to a text, might even quote very small aspects of text. This is very marginal. It doesn't really add much to our understanding of the Buddhist text. But what it does show, it shows us that these texts already existed at the time of Ashoka, very clearly from the archaeological record. And for that reason, it is obviously very important. Okay.
So just to add to that, we did the interesting exercise a little while ago. I asked Venerable Nandiya to count the words in the Pali canon. And because the only way I can do that is by going 1, 2, 3, 4, and that would take some time. But we ended up being essentially 2 million words in the Pali canon. So that's what we have from, that's including the Abhidhamma and everything. In Chinese, we haven't done the Chinese yet, but I would like to do that when we get them all together. I would guess maybe 3 times that. Yeah, that would be my guess. We would end up with maybe 6 million words in the Chinese. But we'll hopefully come back to you with some more accurate data on that. With the Tibetan, so that's about, how many suttas do you think in the Pali Nikayas? About 4,000 or so? Depending on how you count them. But probably in terms of actual genuine suttas, about 4,000 or so. So maybe 10,000 suttas in the Chinese. It's probably something less than that. But anyway. So certainly in the thousands in the Pali and Chinese tradition. In Tibetan, maybe 400 suttas or substantial passages from suttas. And in the Sanskrit, I've just finished preparing about 100 suttas for Sutta Central in Sanskrit. And that's probably the bulk of the ones that we have in any substance of. There's a lot of other fragments and bits and pieces, but that's probably about 100 substantial pieces of suttas in Sanskrit. So that'll give you some idea of the quantities of text that we're dealing with here. This is a little, as usual, I'm throwing in random images here. I'm just Googling early Buddhism. I'm getting images and I'm just throwing them in more or less randomly, okay? So don't blame me. But this was an interesting image, I thought. When you look at it, you first say, okay, the Buddha did not speak English. But then when you start to look at the picture, the more you look at it, the weirder it becomes. I don't think it's a very kind of odd, don't you think it's a very odd picture? This young, looks like a young Western monk sitting in the middle there. No idea who it is. And I can't quite tell where it is. Is it maybe Burma? I think Burma? Yeah, it looks like maybe Burma. So probably Burma about 100 years ago or something. Ananda Metta, you think? Okay, a Scottish monk? Okay, maybe, yeah. Okay. So that would explain why it's weird. He's a Scottish monk from Burma. Aha. Uh-huh. It's just interesting to see that visual to remind us that you know this mix of cultures and things that we're seeing, it's been going on the whole time. And whatever we're seeing in terms of the Dhamma, we're always coming from some kind of interpretation. Okie dokie, so that very fact of interpretation and so on means that we have to pay some attention to the topic of what we call, in philosophy they call epistemology. And epistemology is a very interesting, important philosophical topic from a Buddhist point of view, but we won't get into the theory of it here, but we'll just look at some of the practical applications. How do we actually know what's early, what's late, and so on? What's the basis that we're making all these claims on? And of course, the first and most obvious thing is, well, we can never be certain. And then we'll get all these people come along and say, well, you can't be certain, you can't be certain that global warming's happening, you can't be certain that tobacco causes cancer, you can't be certain that the world's actually round and all of these kinds of things. Well, yeah, it's kind of true, but it's true in a very trivial sense, where we can't be certain, but we can actually know things for all practical and reasonable purposes. And generally speaking, most reasonable people who have looked at the evidence have more or less agreed in the general outlines of what's happened and what the history of Buddhism is and so on and so forth. So these are some of the means by which we come to these conclusions. First one is the testimony of the tradition, by which I mean that traditions themselves actually say things about their own history. Of course, we can't always believe everything that the tradition says, but we should listen to it and we should take it seriously. And in particular, this provides like a kind of a negative filter for understanding the texts. The traditions say that the Buddha taught lots of things. Many of those things the Buddha did not in fact teach. We know that they're later. So we can't assume that if the tradition says the Buddha taught it, therefore he must have taught it. On the other hand, if the tradition does not say that the Buddha taught something, right? If the tradition doesn't make that claim, it's highly unlikely that it actually was taught by the Buddha. Yeah? And so this is actually the testimony of the tradition can be used in some quite interesting ways. The most obvious example of that in the Theravadan tradition, for example, or actually all of the traditions, the texts themselves don't actually say the Buddha taught the Abhidhamma. The Theravadan tradition, the Abhidhamma books don't have any author recorded, and in the Chinese tradition they're attributed to various disciples. So it's only from the much later commentaries, nearly a thousand years later, that we find the claim that these things were spoken by the Buddha, but the texts themselves don't actually say that. Another important criterion is the concordance of the suttas. And so here we're talking about what happens when we compare those massive collections of texts from Pali, Chinese, Tibetan and Sanskrit, put them side by side. Well, what do they agree on? What do they disagree on? And typically we find that the things found in the Nikayas, the early suttas, the kinds of things that we've been talking about during this course, that these are found across multiple traditions, often in a very literal sense, exactly the same words found. Even if they're not found in an exactly literal sense, we find the same teachings and ideas. Whereas in other cases, for example, the Abhidhamma text and the various commentaries and so on, these things don't agree across the traditions in the same way. So this is a very important criteria. Another one is the evolution of doctrine. And there's an internal logic to the way that doctrine evolves. And that internal, this is an interesting one. It's a little bit problematic. It's of all of them, perhaps the most important and even perhaps the most certain. is most important, because the sense where we're talking about what the actual teaching is. Unfortunately, it's somewhat difficult to get it, to understand it, unless you actually know the material very well. But this is something which I think you can probably all understand if you've studied any field. For example, if you studied psychology, then you know that Freud came before Jung, and Jung could not have come before Freud, right? And if you've studied the field and you know what their ideas were, it's completely obvious that this must be the case. It's impossible that Jung could have come along and developed his ideas if Freud hadn't developed his ideas formally. And the same thing applies to people working in any field. Einstein must have come after Newton, and so on and so forth. And if you know the logic of how things work within that field, this is so obvious to you, and it's impossible that it could be the other way around. And so this is very much the case in the Buddhist tradition, that we again and again, not just once or twice, but in virtually every major teaching of the Buddha, we find that it's developed in ways in the later tradition which clearly hark back to the earlier tradition. It's almost impossible to find any teaching at all where that doesn't happen. Similarly, we find the evolution of language. This is a little bit harder to pin down, because we don't necessarily have so many language strata from the different periods. It's a much more specialized field. I mean, pretty much anybody can read even a translated text of, say, the suttas and the Abhidhamma or commentaries or whatever, and see that there's a development of ideas between there. It's much harder to see the development of language, especially when so many texts are translated into other languages, which of course obscures any kind of linguistic development that might have been happening in the original Indic texts. But nevertheless, we can see certain indicators within the text that show an evolution from a earlier, more colloquial form based around Magadhan towards the more formalized Pali we find in the Pali canon, and then even the later forms of Sanskrit and the Pali as developed in the commentaries. And so there is some evolution of language. We also find, and this is something that we've emphasized a lot and we believe is perhaps the most significant in terms of being able to locate the Buddha in history, is the changing in the political, social and technological conditions. And the most dramatic, and just to recap briefly what we talked about earlier, at the time of the Buddha, we had a collection of 16 small nation states in the Ganges Valley region, very little knowledge of anything outside of that region. Okay, it was a contained culture within that region, and that region is geographically pretty much identical with what the archaeologists have discovered, and they call the Northern Black Polished Ware culture. So there is, in fact, a physical basis for the idea that there was a unified cultural region in that area at that time. Actually, one detail that I didn't know, when we were talking about this earlier, we hypothesized that the Northern Black Polished Ware was, in fact, the monks' bowls, right? Which we have is the kind of black polished bowls, which, according to the Vinaya, should be either pottery or iron. And since we did the course on that, I spoke with Venerable Dhammika a few weeks ago, who's a bit of a specialist in ancient Indian history, and he said he's actually seen in India a museum where they have an ancient monk's bowl, which actually is Northern Black polished ware. Yeah? So this is where that culture comes from. So that political, social, and technological situation completely changed within a very short time after the Buddha passed away. Less than 100 years after he passed away was Chandragupta, and by that time the whole of northern India was included within one empire. That empire was no longer sort of parochial and local, but it had strong international links. Chandragupta was married to a Greek wife. It doesn't get much stronger than that. Okay, so and from that point, India is no longer a local culture of individual warring kingdoms, but is part of a massive international trade network with the Greek and later Roman empires to the west, and then to China and Southeast Asia in the east. So that entire situation had completely changed within 100 years, And that change is not mentioned or reflected anywhere at all in any of the early Buddhist texts. And so it seems to me impossible that somebody would have just somehow imagined that early situation and read that back into the text. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So when we talk about the evolution of the doctrine, then there's two aspects of it. One is the aspect of the phrasing. Okay, so how is it explained? And then the other aspect is the aspect of the meaning. Okay, the vyanjana and the atta is the words they use for that in Pali. The vyanjana is the formulation of the doctrine, and the atta is the meaning or the purpose of the doctrine. Okay, now that distinction between those two is already made in the early suttas, and the Buddha said, well, you should try to keep both the phrasing and the meaning accurate. But, well, if your phrasing's not accurate but the meaning's still accurate, then that's the main thing. Okay, so when we look at the doctrine, doctrinal evolution, both of those things are implied. Okay, now what we can say from a historical point of view, the obvious thing is to point at the differences in the phrasing. Okay, the vyanjana. Okay, and that's the part that I was saying is obvious. Anybody can pick up a book from the suttas and an Abhidhamma book and see that the way that the doctrine is talked about and presented is different. That's enough for our purposes, okay? It's enough to show that there is that historical development, yeah? Now, whether that difference in phrasing actually implies a difference in meaning, okay, is, of course, a much more subtle thing and depends on interpretation, depends on context and all of those kinds of things. My personal position is that in some cases the meaning did change, in other cases it didn't, and you have to look at each case take it case by case. So the question is whether that's an interpretation based on cultural aspects. Not necessarily, not at that time. The culture was still fairly uniform, right? We're still talking about Buddhism within mainly the central Indian northern Ganges region. So there weren't massive cultural differences, but mostly in this early phase, around the time of King Ashoka, it was mainly about philosophical disagreements about the interpretation of particular teachings. And like I said, most of those philosophical disagreements at that time were still very minor. Yeah? But you could see that a few of them were starting to raise more fundamental questions about the nature of important teachings, like, say, impermanence or not-self, the nature of enlightenment, and so on. Yeah. Yes. Well, so the question is about how do you tell when the goals are different? I wouldn't whether the goals are that different with Theravada Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism honestly depends on who you ask, so this is why I said that it's much easier to tell the doctrinal evolution of the phrasing of teachings than it is to tell the doctrinal evolution of the meaning of those things. And I've discussed these things with quite a lot of different Tibetan monks and so on and so forth, and it really just depends who you ask. And some of them will say, no, our goal is to get enlightened, and it's exactly the same as what you're doing. And others will say, no, they'll explain it in a different way, just as you'll find within the Theravadan tradition, that there are some who want to attain some kind of eternal consciousness or something like that, and they believe that's the goal of Theravadan practice. So the differences in interpretation you can find anywhere. And so this is why I think it's important when we're studying this and we're studying teachings, studying history, the history of the teachings is really, really important to give the actual text its due. Don't be in a hurry to think you understand the Dhamma and you're going to read what lies behind the text. Okay? That's just arrogance. And if you do that, you're just going to continue to read your own ideas into the text and you won't learn anything from it. Okay? So if you want to try to understand what the text means, you have to subject yourself to it in the most literal way possible. Okay? And it's extremely easy, if you've been hanging around spiritual circles for a while, it's extremely easy to interpret things away. Right? It's very easy. Anyone can do that, right? But to actually understand what the original purpose of the text, it takes discipline and hard work and patience, and it takes humility to say, well, I don't understand. Maybe my ideas were wrong. Yeah? So we give the text its due. Actually, in Sydney, I have a friend who's from the Jewish tradition. They say that they have four ways of understanding any sacred text. One is the literal, one is the metaphorical, one is the in terms of the moral of the story, right? What's the ethical point? And the fourth one is in terms of emptiness, okay? So in terms of the transcendence, each text is pointing to something transcendent. I think it's a very nice framework to use. And she said that the rabbinical teachers always say that the hard one is the literal, okay? It's very easy to draw out metaphors from things. It's very easy to draw out a moral from things. It's very easy to say, sadhu, sadhu, it's all empty, we're all going to get enlightened, this is wonderful. But to actually spend some time with it and actually get down to the nitty-gritty of what that text is saying takes work. And so this is why I'm trying to emphasize, but I'm not trying to say that we should always just stay there, right? I'm not trying to say that we should just stick with the literal meaning of text, right? The texts have a spiritual purpose, and our job as spiritual practitioners is to put them into practice, okay? But we should be patient to take the time to learn exactly what's going on before we take it out and apply it, okay? So we just be patient and take a bit of time to figure out what the text is saying. Okay. Yes, Mary. Yeah. Sure.
What do you say about looking to the biography of the forest monks who are enlightened, like Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Mantapur, Ajahn Chao, and seeing if that could help influence the interpretation one has of the early text?
I mean, I'm kind of struck by the easiness with which you say it because they're enlightened. Maybe they are. I hope they certainly are, but that's kind of an assumption. So if we start with that high level assumption, and then try to read that back into things, then that we end up with the same kind of problem. I would rather, if I was to approach it these days, I would rather approach it from the ground up and again take that approach of saying, well, what are they actually saying? And then one can begin to, if you give their words their due, then one can begin to understand what they might be saying as compared to what's said in the early suttas. But I wouldn't start by making those kinds of assumptions. Yeah. I know, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's always problematic to, you know, assume that somebody is enlightened, particularly somebody you never actually met before. Somebody who can't. I mean, how do you know somebody is enlightened anyway? The way you know that is, if, you know, you look at the conduct, specifically the morality, the kindness, all these other things, and that is actually how you decide whether somebody is awakened. But a lot of these things just hearsay. Okay, Ajahn Mun is enlightened. You hear that from so many people, and you think he is because of that. Really, the way the Buddha talks about these things is, well, you should observe somebody. Huh? And when you observe somebody personally and you see that they have the right conduct, that is when you can make that step and say, okay, perhaps they got something special. Even then you don't know, but at least then you have some kind of real criteria for deciding these things. So it's very, sometimes it's too easy to think that. Maybe they were, but it's actually very, very difficult to actually have any certainty about that. Whereas for the Buddha, and if we assume that we do have the teachings of the Buddha, we have to assume the Buddha was awakened, because if the Buddha wasn't enlightened, well, the whole thing falls apart, right? That's kind of the basic assumption that is required for all the Buddhism to really work. So these teachings have always, as far as I'm concerned, have to take priority. And then the secondary thing will then be the teachings of, you know, contemporary masters or whatever.
I mean, just on that, I mean, this is a kind of a live issue, for example, within Thai Buddhism and the forest tradition. Ajahn Mahabua, for example, was quite adamant to say that the early suttas were wrong and that because they didn't agree with his experience. So, because they didn't have an original mind in them. So there must be something wrong with the suttas. So, you know, so this discussion is happening in different ways in the different cultures, yeah. Okay.
Okay. Can I just say one more? Okay. I just want to say something about the evolution of language there, because I think it's actually quite an important point. And the point there, it may be difficult to show a particular type of evolution going across time, but the point really here is that there is a massive difference in language. There's a difference in language, for example, between the suttas and the Abhidhamma. When you read that, you see that there's a difference in vocabulary, there's a difference in style, there's a difference in context, narrative context, there's a difference in so many different levels. It's very hard to read the suttas and then think that the Abhidhamma was actually written or spoken by the same person, because the style is so different. And this is what you see across the different traditions. You see that there's enormous difference in style as you move from one type of category of text to another category of text. The commentaries, again, are very different again. And so it is across the different traditions. So evolution itself may not be so important. Important here is the actual differences in languages. That tells you a lot about who it was spoken by and who it was not spoken by.
Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, I should have probably put evolution of language and literary style or something like that.
Yeah,
in there. Yeah, actually, I think the literary style as such is probably more important than the language. Yeah, for that reason. I mean, language has some importance. Anyway, moving along. So, which one? Oh, you're doing this one.
Okay. So this is about what is early Buddhism. In other words, what is essentially what we can take as the teachings that we can sort of follow to be most sure are authentic Buddhism, so to speak. And of course, the first one here are the doctrinal passages attributed to the Buddha in the suttas. And this basically means those things that are said in the suttas to have been spoken by the Buddha himself. Perhaps not always. There are perhaps certain exceptions to that, and some of those exceptions are very short passages, but the Buddha just says something like yes, or may you be well, or something like that. And there are also certain suttas where it seems to be attributed to the Buddha, but perhaps was not actually spoken by the Buddha. One of the suttas I can think of is like the Lakkhana Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, which has a lot of that sutta is very clearly laid from other criteria. And this is the point here, what Adasudato was talking about. There's a number of criteria you can use to decide whether a sutta is late or whether it's early. And when a lot of those criteria add up and say this is a late sutta, but it still says it was spoken by the Buddha, then you have grounds for doubt. And this is a classic example, is the Lakkhana Sutta. The Lakkhana Sutta is about the topic of the characteristics of the great man, and it is a very kind of strange sutta in many ways. And this sutta has many of those characteristics that makes it very clear that it is a late sutta. For example, the verses there have a very late meter. They have the structure of the verse is very late. And the whole sutta has a very kind of repetitive and doesn't really match with other suttas in the canon there. So this is, these are general criteria and not absolute ones. So most of the doctrinal passages attributed to the Buddha, some of the framing narratives and the teachings by the disciples. Remember here that when you have a sutta, you have like the core aspect of the sutta is the word of the Buddha or the word of the disciple. Now, outside of that core discourse by the Buddha, you have a framing narrative which says something about where the sutta was spoken, who was present, etc. And then you have a closing remark which says perhaps, how many people decided to become monks as a consequence of the teaching, how many people got awakened, etc. And there's a difference there in it is stratified differently. Obviously, the what was spoken by the Buddha is more basic and more fundamental. And the narrative framework was added afterwards for obvious reasons. And you can actually see that in the first council where the monks came together after the Buddha's passing away. One of the things you find there is that Mahakasapa, the great disciple of the Buddha, he asks Ananda, where was this sutta spoken, right? And so the point there, of course, is that if he asked that question, this could not have been part of the sutta at that time, right? It was added at a later time. But because it was supposedly then said by Ananda, and I think there's no reason to doubt that may have been the case in many, for many of the suttas at least, that obviously isn't part of the early teachings. Some narrative, some of this framework was added much later on, and for that reason doesn't have the same status of being early. Then you have the Vinaya. This is, of course, the discipline part of the suttas. The suttas are, or rather, of the canon. So you have the suttas, you have the Vinaya. And the Vinaya is a very different type of document from the suttas, whereas the suttas are essentially the word of the Buddha, and for that reason are basically early, almost in all cases. The Vinaya is a layered, it's a structured document. It has a very clear chronological sequence due to the structure. And the most basic part of that chronological structure is the Patimokkha rules. These are the Vinaya rules that are kept by the monastics, right? And on top of that, you have certain parts of the Vinaya which are known as Sangha-kamma. These are the actions that are done by the monastic community, like ordination, like the Uposatha ceremony, etc. These are like the foundational aspects of the Vinaya. But then the Vinaya itself contains like a commentary, for example, on the Patimokkha rules, right? Now, a commentary, by definition, must come after the thing it comments on, right? First comes the thing, the statement, then comes the commentary. So you can see there, actually, a chronological stratification within the Vinaya itself. And there are many criteria for deciding that parts of the Vinaya actually are much later than the Patimokkha rules. That is an important thing. The suttas are the most basic. And once you get to the Vinaya already, you have to be more careful. Then you have other aspects of the suttas. Now we're getting moving on. What I have talked about so far is basically the four main Nikaya. This is where the teachings are. So the Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, the Sanyutta Nikaya, and the Anguttara Nikaya. These are the four places where you find most of the doctrinal teachings. Once you move outside of that, everything gets much more wishy-washy and much less clearly defined. So once you get to the Kudaka Nikaya, the fifth Nikaya of the Buddhist doctrine, that's where you have the Dhammapada, for example. That's where you have the Sutta Nipata, etc. The picture is much more complicated. So within the Dhammapada, you will find that there are verses that obviously are very ancient. The meter is right. In other words, the structure is right. There may just be copies of verses found elsewhere in the suttas. So they are clearly ancient. But the Dhammapada is a compilation. And as a compilation, it happened over clearly a fairly long period of time. And if you compare the Dhammapada of the Theravadas, compare that to the Chinese Dhammapadas that we have, they can often be very, very different. For example, the Theravada Dhammapada has about 430 verses or thereabouts, whereas some of the Chinese versions of the Dhammapada, they even have a different name, some of these. They're called the Udana Varga, which really refers to the Udana instead. They have often over 1,000 verses in them. So it shows you how these are compilations. So essentially, when you talk about early Buddhism, if you want to know the teachings, it is the four main Nikayas. That's what you're talking about. The very last thing here, the occasional quotes in later literature, that is actually quite an interesting point and quite important to keep in mind. Because the point is that even in the Abhidhamma, for example, which is generally agreed to be later than the suttas, or take the Mahayana suttas, which arose several hundred years after the early suttas, even there, sometimes you find quotes. They take a passage from the early suttas, and then they explain that passage in their own way, right? And that is important, because that quote itself may actually come from a very early time. And because the quote itself comes from a very early time, it may be very useful if you do like comparative studies of suttas. And sometimes you can find, even in Mahayana texts, quotes from early Buddhism that can be useful to reconstruct sometimes the very earliest suttas.
I've just been working with a Sanskrit text called the Artha Vinishraya Sutra, which calls itself a Mahayana Sutra, but which in fact consists almost entirely of quotes from the early suttas on basic teachings like the five khandhas, the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, and so on and so forth, and doesn't even have any elaboration or anything. It just quotes pretty much straight out of the early suttas, and that's what about 95% of that particular text consists of. So there certainly is a continuation of the awareness of the teachings found in the early suttas at later times. And if we use our understanding of the early suttas, then we can understand how the different traditions have developed that. Okay, so let's do some now meditation. Here's your meditation object. Okay, so now moving ahead once more. I was going to say exactly the same thing. Okay, so what's not early? Pretty much everything that wasn't on the previous slide. Abhidhamma, Jataka's late books in the Khuddaka Nikaya. Most of the Vinaya, that is excluding the Parimokkha and some other parts, Mahayana texts, some additions to the early Agamas and Nikayas, some verses, legendary elaborations and proto-Abhidhamma texts, and the biographies of the Buddha, which became extremely popular in later times. In Pali we have the Jataka Nidana, in Sanskrit various ones, the Buddhacharita, Mahavastu, Lalita Vistara, and so on. Okay. This is Martin
Skuyen.
That's what I was going to say, Skuyen. And so there's another random picture here, but he's the, I think this is him, pretty sure this is him. Anyway, this is from his collection, but he's a Norwegian collector of ancient artifacts. And part of his collection is ancient Buddhist texts, and you can see here this is some of the manuscripts that we've been talking about, and so this would be, I'm not exactly sure which one this is, but this is a this would be birch bark recovered from Afghanistan, and they would be written probably in Sanskrit, possibly in Gandhari. These particular leaves are fairly complete. You can see there are some fragments, but mostly you can read the lines fairly easily. But, of course, you can see some are broken off on the edges and so on. And often the leaves are much less complete than that. But anyway, this is some of the source by which we can reconstruct some of these ancient Sanskrit texts. Okay, ethics. Is that you or me now?
My turn.
It's your turn. It's your turn. Yeah, here we go. Ethics. Ethics and cupcakes.
Okay, so now we are moving on from the what are the early texts to the actual contents of the early texts. This is about the contents of the early texts. So what does the early text have to say about ethics? And we have divided this up, as you may remember, between the three kind of main divisions in Buddhism, in a Buddhist path, which is the ethics, meditation and wisdom division. So we're just going to start with the first division, which is ethics. And why be ethical is obviously an important question. And sometimes when I hear people say things about ethics, you often hear they say things like, oh, you know, I'm ethical just for the sake of it. And I think, just for the sake of it, what does that mean? How can you be ethical just for the sake of it? Everything in life seems to have consequences, right? When you do something, it has a consequence. How can you do something just for the sake of it? It seems to me to be probably what they mean is that there is some reason there, but they can't really put their finger on it, probably. But in Buddhism, we try to put our finger on these things very clearly, to be very clear about why we're doing things. So the first one here, of course, is ethics is about happiness, right? And this is one of the things which are very important, because these other things that I have on the list here, rebirth and awakening, are not something that you can be in direct touch with necessarily, whereas happiness is something you can understand right here, right now. And I think one of the important things as a Buddhist is always to reflect on that connection between one's conduct, the way one is, and the happiness you experience in daily life. Why is it that sometimes you feel very happy? Why is it that occasionally everything is certainly going really well, you feel good about yourself? And you will, if you reflect rightly, you will see that the reason why you feel happy sometimes, you feel at ease, you feel relaxed, you feel a sense of joy, the reason is always because there's something in the background, some memory, something which is there, which actually creates that happiness. And that is always going to be ethical conduct, which is there, which is at the background. Or perhaps something higher, like samadhi or wisdom, but certainly ethical conduct is always going to be there. So it creates happiness. This is one of the most important reasons, of course, why one should be ethical. Not just for oneself, but of course also for others. And for me, this is one of the beautiful ways of defining what is a religious, what is a Buddhist action, right? Well, a Buddhist action is something which does something good both for yourself and for others. That's when you know you're doing a good act, both for yourself and others, is a Buddhist action. So this is the basic purpose of ethics. Second reason, of course, is rebirth. Now we're moving into the more Buddhist idea of things. And this is basically just about the idea of karma and how our actions in this life then lead on to a good destination in the future. It's important here to understand that this is a bit more complicated than sometimes you get to see in kind of typical Buddhist books, Buddhist ideas about these things. If you read typical Buddhist books like the Vimanavatthu is about, you know, how good actions can lead to rebirth in a heavenly realm. Often they will point to the rebirth being caused by a specific action in the past. You gave to an arahant a gift, right? For that reason, you get this enormous mansion in heaven. It sounds good, but the idea here of ethics is much broader than that, right? It's about your whole life, how you conduct yourself as a person. What is your general conduct as a person? How do you generally think about the world and yourself? Ethics is this broad thing. That is what matters for rebirth, not specific actions. And this is why going to the monastery and giving dana once a week is a wonderful thing to do, but it's not in itself ethics. It's not a full set of ethics in its own right, right? You need to broaden it out and to bring in much your whole conduct as a person is what really matters here. And of course, the good news is that not only does it do these things, but it also is the very foundation for awakening. You need ethics to awaken. And the reason for that is because you need ethics to be able to get into deep meditation practice. Without ethics, there's no way you're going to be able to get into deep meditation. And because of that, and because deep meditation itself is the causal factor, the most important causal factor for awakening to happen, this is absolutely necessary. So ethics is a wonderful thing. It gives you all these beautiful things. And even if you are ethical just because you want to be happy in this life, and these other things are too uncertain, good enough. If it has its other benefits as well, wow, it becomes incredibly powerful indeed. So, okay, Bhante.
Right, next one. Happiness and intention. So this is Buddhist ethics is always very closely related to happiness, and as such is I think is related to, not identical with, but related to the European ethical philosophy of utilitarianism. The basic idea is that when you do good, you become happy. But there's also an idea in Buddhism that you have an intention which underlies the ethical choice. And those intentions, of course, are those intentions that are fueled by either greed, hatred, and delusion, or else non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. And the good thing about this is this both tells us where it's coming from and where it's going to. And that gives us, that's really useful because then that gives us a two-way means of assessing any ethical act that we have. If we're coming from letting go, from loving kindness and so on, then the result of that should be happiness. The problem, of course, is that mind is complicated. Motives are blurry. Sometimes we think we're doing something for a good reason, but we're not, right? Sometimes we think we're doing something for a bad reason, but actually there is something good behind it. And so these things become complicated. But when you can test it, both in terms of what your intentions are and in terms of what the results are, then that gives you a much better basis for being able to really reflect and understand what your good intentions are. Because, understand whether this is an ethical choice. And the crucial thing is that both of these things are knowable. Our happiness or sadness, our psychological state, this is something that we can know. Our intentions are something that we can know. Especially these become clear in meditation. But even outside of meditation, we can know what these things are. And so this gives us a very solid grounding of ethics in a psychological reality. So that the ethics from a Buddhist point of view is very much an empirical teaching of ethics, rather than being some kind of metaphysical doctrine that somehow the Buddha said it's wrong, therefore it must be wrong. But it's about understanding your own mind and the effects of your actions. Yeah. Well, no, that you'd find both. I think, as in any situation, there are both people who have a distinct philosophy of life and others who don't really. I think that's pretty much the case all the time, and you meet that a lot of the time in the suttas. You find a very great variety of the discussions that the Buddha had with all the different kinds of people. Some of them are just lost, they don't know what they're doing. Others are very firm that they know exactly what's right and what's wrong. So the Buddha addressed both of those. Any other questions? Well, do you have a comment to make about the cupcake? Well, I was going to say, this is just like your meditation, isn't it? The kind of the middle of it's nice and sweet and delicious and so on. And the patty is just like, this is like the framework that holds your meditation together. So this is like the place that you meditate, your seat, the time that you meditate. It gives you a boundary that stops it from splunging out all over the place.
You have some special deal with Mara here, Bhante? Yeah. This is looking a bit dodgy here.
Don't you know the sutta where the Buddha said your meditation is just like a sweet little cupcake? You haven't been doing your homework. Okay, so the next... Go on. Is it? Oh, it's your turn. Oh, okay, sorry, it's yours. Go on, please.
Okay, so this is just basically an alternative way of looking at the Buddhist path. And this is one of the nice things about the suttas. You find all kind of different ways of looking at the Buddhist path. So this is just another way of looking at the Eightfold Path, really. And you can see here things like learning and discussion. They obviously relate to right view, right? You're clarifying what is the right way of looking at the world. You learn the Buddha's teachings. Based on confidence in the Buddha, you take that view on board. And then you have the ethics part, which is obviously part of the Noble Eightfold Path. And you have calm, which is like the... Satipatthana, the seventh and eighth factor, the right mindfulness and the right samadhi, and then you have the insight part, the wisdom part at the end. So this is just other way of looking at this path. But the reason why this is interesting here is precisely because of the two factors of learning and discussion. It's an unusual way of looking at the idea of right view, because these are actually very important aspects in the Buddha's teachings, the idea of learning the teachings. When you learn the teachings, when you read them, not only do you read them, but you reflect on them afterwards. You try to make them real. Does this actually fit with the way life actually is? Is there suffering? Is there really a problem or isn't there? And this idea of reflecting and learning on the teachings is actually very, very foundational. You find this many, many places in the suttas, the Buddha talking about this. And because it is so foundational, I think it's important to keep this in mind and actually practice this. And this is one reason you will see towards the very end of this slideshow, one of the things that we suggest is particularly reading the suttas to get that learning and understanding of what the Buddha taught. And so that is foundational. And discussion here, you could also maybe call that Q&A, because often discussion doesn't just mean necessarily discussing between peers. Often what it means, like going to a teacher and saying, you know, okay, what's going on here? I don't understand this. What's happening here? I've thought about this a lot. I can't figure it out. So discussion is also this idea of Q&A, going to somebody you respect for their understanding and insight, and then hopefully gaining something more from that. So this is then a very important part, a very foundational part of this whole idea of Buddhism. And you find that when you start learning about the Buddha's teachings, either you find, wow, this is so true to life, and you get very attracted to it, or you may find, actually, this is a bit too much. And this is another thing that we will look at later on about this, is the problem that Buddhism sometimes can be so challenging to people that they're often rejected because of the challenge. But either way, it's good to know what you're dealing with, and this is what this is about. Okay.
Okay. So some more details about meditation, and so, of course, we're only just going to very, very briefly summarizing these topics that we looked at in the early workshops. Even in the early workshops, we were only able to very briefly summarize them. And actually, this is one of the things that we wanted to discuss maybe later in the day. We've been talking about possibly doing a similar kind of course next year, and maybe you doing a more specialized one, focusing on a particular area or a particular topic. And so maybe it'd be something if you can think about, if there's anything that you'd like to see us look at in more closely, in more detail, maybe we'll think about that. Anyway, so here's just some of the words which the Buddha used for talking about meditation. Citta bhavana, the development of the mind, literally the enlarging of the mind. Citta bhavana. It's a really important word, actually. Citta bhavana, making more of your mind. Samadhi, oneness, stillness, coalescence, everything coming together. Jhana, absorption. Doesn't really mean absorption, but it seems to be a reasonably okay translation. Samatha, tranquility, evenness, peacefulness, stillness. Vipassana, discernment, insight, clear seeing. Anupassana, very similar meaning to vipassana, but has more of a meaning of sustained observation. Then, of course, you have satipatthana, the four establishments of mindfulness, right, being four kinds of ways in which you can establish your mindfulness on the body, feelings, awareness, and dhammas. Brahma viharas, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, emotional development. And patisankha is another phrase we use. There's actually a whole range of phrases with a similar meaning we find in the Pali. But patisankha means something like reflecting or right perspective on things. And there's actually quite a lot you find within the suttas where the Buddha will actually give different reflections on how to do things. So, for example, you reflect on that I'm of the nature to age, I haven't gone beyond aging and so on. I'm of the nature to die, I'm not going to go beyond dying and so on. And these kind of reflections is another aspect of meditation as taught in the suttas. Interestingly enough, what you don't find the Buddha talking about in the suttas, he doesn't talk about making yourself endure through pain. That's not found in the suttas. What else isn't that? What other contemporary meditation cliches do we not find in the suttas? Trying to force yourself to pay attention to an object, or the idea of a meditation object is not found in the suttas. There's no even vaguely similar word for object that we find in the suttas. Yeah? Yeah?
Except for nimitta.
But even nimitta doesn't mean object in that sense. It means a characteristic or sign.
No, sometimes I think it means object, actually. Yeah. Like in the, you have the, anyway.
We could disagree about that. Let's disagree with that. Okay. Dani, you've had a lot, but we'll come to... Yep. Yes, loving kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity. Yeah. As opposed to developing hatred and these kinds of things. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's interestingly enough in the suttas, they don't, they talk about developing these quite a lot and give a lot of different ways. But it is quite interesting that in the Visuddhimagga, it gives a very nice parable of how the development of those four Brahmaviharas is like the emotional development of a mother during the lifetime of her child. And it's actually, I think, one of the earliest examples of a sort of an explicit, very clear sort of process of emotional psychological development, which is described in any ancient text found in the Visuddhimagga. And also interesting that it's talking about the emotional development of a mother, i.e. an adult, rather than that of a child. Which also is quite interesting because one of the characteristics of early Western psychology, especially under Freud, was to focus very much on childhood development. But people don't stop developing when they get when they grow up. Yeah. So, yes. So is the same word again?
It's the word is knowledge.
Ah, okay. It's a different word, yeah. So there's one. This is the word jhana in Pali, which in Sanskrit is dhyana. There's another word which is sometimes can be mistaken from it, which is in Pali jnana, meaning knowledge, and in Sanskrit that's spelled jnana with J-N-A-N-A. So it looks a bit similar to jhana, but it's actually a different word. Yeah, the Sanskrit form is dhyana. Yes. Anupassana is usually used in the context of, say, satipatthana. So anupassana is what is kaya kaya anupassi viharati. One abides contemplating a body in the body. So it basically has the idea of sustained observation of something, whereas patisankha has more the meaning of reflecting about something. Not really, but anupassana is used a bit more broadly, but basically anupassana is how satipatthana is described. It says, what is the four satipatthanas? It says sustained observation of these things. Yeah. He didn't use the word object when talking about the breath. Yeah? So you do anapanasati, you're mindful of the breathing. But that's a different way of talking about it to saying you take the breath as an object. Sorry? Yeah? Well, again, kasina has a completely different meaning in the early suttas to what it has in the later times. Kasina in the early, in later Buddhist tradition means, and specifically an object, even a physical object, right, where you make a disc of a certain colour or a certain material and you literally look at that until you develop a mental image of that which is clear enough to sustain your meditation. That whole idea is completely absent in the suttas. The word kasina in the suttas means totality. And in fact means almost the opposite of what a meditation object is. And the way that the kasina is described specifically, it says one contemplates the earth kasina, the earth totality or the earth universal, non-dual and infinite. Yeah, advayang. So it's specifically not an object. It's non-dual. Yeah. Yes. Anusati is more to continually recollect something to mind. So you have a particular thing, like anusati is like recollection of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. So you have something which you know and you're continually bringing it up to mind is anusati. Whereas patisankha, again, is reflecting about something. Yeah. Well, the classical example is on the four requisites, right? We have patisankha yoni sopindabhatan patisevami. So you're reflecting about the alms food that you're eating. So you say, okay, well, this alms food was produced from the earth. It was made by these people. It was offered as dana. I'm here to use this as my alms food for the day. And the purpose is to sustain my Dhamma practice. So I should use it in the appropriate way and so on. So you're reflecting about it, right? Whereas, say, anupassana would be simply holding it in your mind. One thing. It's not reflecting about it. Anusati is what you do when you go back to your kuti after the meal and you think, wow, that chocolate cupcake was really delicious. And you keep on thinking about it again and again and again. Micha anusati. Yes, I am. Uh-huh. What is that? Not meditation. Well, interestingly enough, one of my talks has just been translated into Polish with the title of How to Do Not Meditation. So so you can read all about that in Polish. Yeah. Not meditation can be quite a broad topic. Do you have anything specifically in mind? Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, look, I don't really know enough about it, I'm afraid. Yeah, be able to talk about it.
I think on about what is meditation, what isn't meditation, you can look at it from a point of view of purpose. And the purpose of meditation is to purify yourself, right? So if it does the job of purifying yourself, you become more peaceful, you become have less defilements, then it is meditation. If it, on the other hand, if it leads the other direction, then it's not meditation. Yeah. If it's awareness of what? Yeah.
I just learned Polish, that's all I have to say. Okay, moving on. Your turn.
Okay. So this is just a quick summary of how early Buddhism differs from modern Buddhism, if you like, 20th century meditation. Here we have the first one here, samatha with vipassana versus samatha against vipassana. You often hear the idea these days that you can do either samatha meditation or vipassana meditation. But of course, the reality in the sutta is that samatha and vipassana often usually go together. There's an interesting distinction that you can make here. And the distinction we can make is between the theme of meditation and the result of meditation. And the theme of meditation can often either be a samatha theme or a vipassana theme. So if you do a meditation on the breath, for example, you would say that's a samatha theme because it tends to make you peace, because it is like a peaceful theme. It's a theme which unifies the mind. On the other hand, you can have a vipassana theme. Vipassana theme would be when you do contemplate the three characteristics, right? Dukkha, anicca, dukkha, anatta. When you contemplate those, that's a vipassana theme. For example, contemplating death would normally be a vipassana theme. But the point is that both of these themes, they lead to both samatha and vipassana. So the result of vipassana samatha is usually the result of the vipassana theme and the samatha theme are both samatha and vipassana. There might be slight variation. One may lead to a little bit more samatha, one to a little bit more vipassana. But if they work, they lead to both. And that is, I think, the really important point of any meditation practice. Any real meditation makes you both more calm and you see more clearly. Both should go together. So once you look at that, from a difference between theme and result, it actually starts to make a little bit sense what is going on there. And that's how you can, one way of distinguishing these things. Then we have the idea of satipatthana leads to jhana versus satipatthana equals vipassana. This idea that satipatthana equals vipassana is a modern idea. If we look at the suttas, how satipatthana relates to the other factors of the path in the suttas, it's always satipatthana is a step which takes you towards jhana, or in other words, samadhi. It's a very important part in the suttas. And the reason why the satipatthana equals vipassana tends to arise, these kind of ideas, is if you look exclusively at the satipatthana sutta, if you look at satipatthana more broadly in the sutta, it's very clear what is going on there. This is a very important point. What that means is that satipatthana, again, is a practice you do. It can have a samatha theme, it can perhaps have a vipassana theme, but it always leads to both samatha and vipassana as a result. It goes to jhana, basically. Bliss is essential versus bliss is dangerous. This is the idea that you sometimes can hear, that you have to be careful of too much happiness in meditation. You might get attached to it or whatever. But of course, in the suttas, you find that the whole psychology of meditation is based on happiness. There is no real meditation without happiness. Only happiness is real meditation, according to the suttas. This is incredibly important, isn't it? If the whole of meditation is based on happiness and bliss, then basically by saying bliss is dangerous, you're kind of you're going absolutely away from what is the true teaching of the Buddha according to the early suttas. It's a very, very important point. Skillful elimination versus suppression of the hindrances. This is more perhaps something to do with how we use vocabulary to explain things. And the problem here is that often when you use the word suppression, you have this idea of using willpower, right? Use willpower to hold your anger in check. I'm going to really squash that anger into the back corner of my mind. Of course, if you do squash the anger into the back corner of your mind, it's going to pop out again just like that and come back with a vengeance. So skillful elimination here means using wisdom. And why shouldn't I be angry here? There's lots of skillful ways of thinking about anger and irritation, which eliminates anger very fast. So this is using wisdom rather than using willpower here. Stillness versus concentration. This is another point here. It's simply, again, the importance of how we translate terms, how we talk about things. Concentration often has this idea, again, of using willpower, right? You force yourself onto a top subject. You concentrate on writing that report. You concentrate on reading this book. You may not like this book, but you have to read it because of your miserable job or whatever it is. So then you force yourself. And of course, when you force yourself, you become tired. So concentration has this downside often, whereas stillness perhaps does not. So there's always this, how we translate things actually often is very important. This is one of the points of the last one there.
So I'll just skip through, because we're running out of time a little bit, I'll skip through the next couple of slides very briefly before getting on to wisdom. These are just a couple of teachings from the Meghya Sutta, also on meditation. As mentioned before, good friendship, virtue, getting right teachings, effort and wisdom, these are things which are supportive for the meditation practice. The important point here is to remember that you don't improve your meditation just by sort of forcing it and pushing it and going to lots of meditation retreats, but you develop a sort of a broad and a thorough kind of spiritual basis for your life, which is ultimately the best foundation for developing higher meditation. Also, just a reminder that the Buddha taught many different kinds of meditations. This particular group of four I like a lot. This is from the Meghya Sutta, and we find similar groups in many different places in the suttas. So it's certainly not the case that the Buddha taught only one kind of meditation, or that he taught students to only practice one kind. He actually taught people to practice many kinds of different meditations, because each has its own benefits. So, again, random slide there. There's some monks in Burma. Oh, I just thought that was a nice photo. Getting ready to go for arms round, looks like. Okay, so function of wisdom.
Okay, so basically this just shows the evolution of wisdom, I suppose, ethics, meditation, wisdom, and freedom. So it shows you why you want to be wise. So is that the idea behind this? Yeah? Okay, so you want to be wise because it actually leads somewhere. Wisdom is not necessarily an end in itself. Of course, wisdom has many aspects to it which are very helpful. It makes you a more happy person, you're a more balanced person, you have all these advantages of being wise. But again, wisdom is not, in Buddhism, an end in itself. The purpose of wisdom is freedom. Freedom from suffering, in particular. Freedom from defilements. So this whole gradual sequence, ethics, meditation, wisdom, and then freedom, ultimately, is what we're aiming for here.
Okay, so there's some various stages of wisdom. And this is, again, it's just a rough scheme. You can find similar kinds of things in the suttas in various places. This is not strictly taken from any one particular place in the sutta, but this is mainly meant to outline the fact that the early texts talk about wisdom in several different kinds of ways. But in all of those cases, it's about something which is practical and which you can develop. Wisdom is not an innate capacity. It doesn't simply happen that some people are wise and other people are not. Wisdom is something that we develop. We develop from listening and learning, bahusutta, by reflecting, patisankara comes up again, reflecting about what it is that we've heard, discussing it, applying it to our own experience, yoniso manasikara. And you hear that teaching, you say, well, is that the case? Apply it to your own experience. Clear discernment, vipassana. Knowing of reality. So typically we use vipassana more in a more limited sense to mean contemplation of impermanent suffering and not self, as developed in meditation. It tends to have that more specialized sense of wisdom, specifically developing wisdom in meditation. Yathabhuta jnana dasana, knowing reality or knowing things as they really are, someone's sometimes translated, mostly in the suttas refers to stream entry. It occurs in a lot of different kinds of places, but most typically this refers to this vision of the Four Noble Truths experienced by the stream enterer. than knowing the end of affliction, the end of asavas or defilements. Asava kayanjana is the knowledge of the arahant. Pachavekana is also an interesting thing which we find mentioned quite a few times in the suttas. I put it here at the end because it's basically pachavekana means looking back over what has happened. And of course pachavekana applies at every stage through the practice, right? From learning and reflecting, discussing and so on. Always that idea that you can look back and learn from what it is that you've done. And through that process of reviewing, it helps to consolidate and to deepen your wisdom. Reviewing is knowing because you can only know afterwards. When you're eating a chocolate cupcake, don't you know that it tastes good? Don't you know that at the time? You don't know everything about the experience. You don't know how many calories it was and all those things. Yeah. Okay, so shall I do this little slide? So this is just a little summary of how wisdom works that I made for the wisdom workshop. Wisdom is informed by knowledge. Okay, so we start out by being informed by knowledge. Very important. We have to start with facts. Start with simple things. Always, I find this is something which is almost. It seems to be so basic that it shouldn't need mentioning, but I find it gets ignored time and time again when you have people who disagree with each other and you have different conflicts and things like that. The last thing people want to do is actually find out what the facts are. Everyone's so convinced that they know what the answers are. And you say, and to me that's always one of the most helpful things if you want to try to discern when there's different accounts of a situation. The first thing you sit down is to say, well, what are the facts? And try to at least do that much. Informed by knowledge, expressed through morality. This is something which I omitted from when I did this in the wisdom workshop, and Ajahn Brahmali suggested it, that wisdom is not something which is merely an idea or a theory, but if it's not actually expressed in your behaviour through wise acts, then there's something lacking with that wisdom. It's integrated in stillness. So what this means is that when your mind becomes still, then the different parts of your mind will tend to work together. Normally, our mind, we're quite good at compartmentalizing our minds. We learn bits of things in different contexts, but we don't take things from one context and apply it to another context. We keep things into separate bits. And this is one of the greatest obstacles to the deepening of wisdom. And so as we develop and as we develop our spiritual practice, we gradually bring those parts together. So that would mean, just to give a simple example, we've all heard the teaching of impermanence. We sit there in a Dhamma talk or we read a sutta and we hear impermanence and this is wonderful. But then when we actually buy the chocolate cupcake, we don't think of it as impermanent before we start eating it. We only think of it as impermanent after we've finished, right? And so that's a lack of integration, that we don't apply the teachings to these different aspects of our mind. And the foremost thing in integrating it is the teachings is stillness, i.e. samadhi. Wisdom is accompanied by confidence. Yeah? Also very important. This is like when true wisdom happens, that there's a sense of knowing. And a sense of as an emotional connotation that it has that brings about like an ending of doubt, an ending of an emotional turmoil. And so as a result of that, it leads to peace. So if it's real wisdom, it leads to peace. Four Noble Truths. Yes, this is the last one. Question? Can you de-wisify? So the question is de-wisification possible? otherwise known as dummerizing. Look, I think obviously it can be. Obviously, and that happens to us every day. We can be more or less intelligent at different times of the day. Our mind's more or less clear. We can make less or more or less wise choices. But I do think that on the whole, wisdom does have a direction to it, and that most people, most of the time, there tends to be an accumulation of wisdom and experience. I don't think it's an absolute truth, but I certainly think it's a general truth.
What is one of the things you find in the sutra? They say that the hindrances or the defilements of the mind, they are panya nirodhika. Nirodhika means to cease, and panya is wisdom, so they actually cause wisdom to cease. So if you in general are practicing in such a way that your hindrances are increasing in the general sense, then also your wisdom is declining at the same time. But the other thing is, obviously if you have a kind of a spiritual teaching like Buddhism that you kind of rely on in life, you have something to sort of guide you in the right direction. But let's say you get reborn in next life. You don't get reborn. You get reborn in a Muslim country instead. You don't have those teachings there anymore, right? They're gone. They disappeared. If you read them, you get put in jail. That is when you have a problem. So the problem is
still
that...
still watch the Friday night talks on YouTube.
Okay, so there you are. So the point is that, in this life, there is a certain kind of view which has already been set in motion, which is there. But once that view doesn't get any reinforcement, perhaps in the future, that might just disappear and go out of the window again. Yeah.
A suffering, a summary of the Four Noble Truths?
Okay, Four Noble Truths, suffering. So I think the most important thing to understand about suffering here is that it is not just a adding up of all the sufferings in one's life. That's of course part of it, but it's only a limited part of it. You can think about all the sufferings, you can add them up, and you can think, yeah, there's a problem here. That is important in its own right, because it's something that we can see right away, but it's more profound than that. To understand suffering is actually an insight. It's about an insight into reality. And it's only when you have that profound insight that you can fully understand what suffering is about. And for that reason, it's important to keep that in mind, that this is not just an immediately experiential thing, it's something much more profound than that. The origination of suffering is, according to the Buddha, is craving. And the most important aspect of that craving is the fact that it is the craving that leads to rebirth. It's a very specific type of craving. That is the craving which is the problem. And of course, again, that is because the first insight about suffering, basically, which is that existence is equivalent to suffering. That's basically what the first thing is about. Now, craving is what creates existence. That's why it is the problem, right? Often we say that craving in daily life causes suffering. Actually, craving more like is suffering in daily life. It can cause it as well. But in the end, it is the craving which leads to rebirth, which is the problem. Cessation, therefore, is the cessation of that particular craving which leads to rebirth. That is what then causes the problem. And the point here, part of the point here, is that once you end that craving, that's all you really have to do. There's nothing else. That is the sole source of the problem. So you end that, then the whole thing comes to an end. The problem has ceased, called cessation. And then the path at the end, of course, is the path which leads to that very cessation. So you have almost like a medical metaphor here. You have the diagnosis, there is suffering. And then you have the cause of that, of course, the origination. And it can cease. And then you have the medicine you need to take, which is the path. So that, of course, in Buddhism, you find in the suttas, the path is what is emphasized again and again and again in the suttas. That is what the Buddha talks about more than anything else, because this is what we have to apply. So it is, I would say, the most important aspect, probably, of the Buddha's teachings. Okay.
So we're a bit over time for lunch anyway, so we should break here, and we'll be back at 12:30 for the afternoon session. And for the afternoon session, we're going to hopefully make it much more of a discussion-based session. and to try to bring some ideas about how to integrate early Buddhism and so on. Anyway, so have a nice lunch and we'll see you back here at 12:30.